Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. I hope you're doing well. My name, of course, is Jeremy. I'm the host of the Taurus Data Science podcast, and I'm also on the team over the Sharpest Minds Data Science Mentorship Program. And we actually took a break last week. We didn't release an episode. I wanted to open this up just by explaining why we paused and what we're doing a little bit differently going forward. So first off, the reason for the pause is that we're working on the next series of episodes. Those episodes are going to be focused a little bit more on questions surrounding how we deploy AI systems for the benefit of humanity. As our AI systems have become more and more powerful, increasingly it's become important to start asking questions like, should we actually deploy an AI system to solve this particular problem? Or what could go wrong if we start to deploy increasingly powerful AI systems in this subdomain? There are all kinds of questions around safety, both in the short term, where we start asking questions like, you know, could an AI system accidentally recommend a course of action that might lead to harm to human beings or damage to economies, all the way to more fundamental and perhaps more concerning long-term questions like, are AI systems actually reflecting human values, shaping humanity into a form that we want? And are AI systems actually safe from a more existential standpoint? Is there the possibility that an arbitrarily intelligent system might have implications for the continued existence of humanity itself that we might want to consider sooner rather than later? And so that's going to be the focus going forward. A lot of questions surrounding ethics, bias in AI systems, and the should we, shouldn't we questions around distribution and deployment. So I'm really excited to dive into this whole series. We have such great guests lined up, and it was so hard to pick one to start that I ultimately ended up sitting back and thinking about the person who I knew who I'd be most comfortable with talking about all these topics, not just AI ethics, not just AI bias, not just the technical details of AI alignment, but somebody who would cover all those bases with me. And I landed on my brother Ed, who's been on the podcast before. He is a co-founder with me of Sharpest Minds, and he's actually got a whole bunch of experience on technical alignment work, as well as startup work, seeing algorithms deployed in the wild. And because of his breadth of experience and depth of focus in the AI safety area, I really decided he'd be the best person for me to open things up with. So I hope you enjoyed this conversation. It's going to be a little bit more offbeat than some of the ones we've had in the past. But if you have any feedback, let me know. And I just can't wait to release the next couple episodes. I think we're exploring a really exciting topic here. And it'll be great to share these thoughts with the community and get your feedback as well on how we're doing. So without any further ado, please enjoy the show.
Hi, Ed. Thanks for joining me for the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Oh, yeah, no problem at all. Geez, I think there are so many places we could start with this. AI is a really big space, and questions around how AI should be used, how it should be secured, are starting to pop up. Obviously, that's the theme of this entire series of the podcast and what we'll be focusing on for the next few episodes. I guess maybe to begin with, we could talk about so many different things, but you're more focused on this idea of AI alignment, getting machine learning models to do what we want them to do in different forms, making sure that their performance isn't dangerous, essentially, to human beings, and that it optimizes in a direction that we want. Can you introduce the idea, the field of AI alignment? Like, why should we be spending time and effort focusing on aligning our machine learning algorithms?
Yeah, so this is something that I have been thinking about more recently as systems have gotten more powerful. And as we're seeing the advance from year to year, the more powerful the systems get, the more important it is that they are doing the things that we want. And alignment is important because it's not always obvious that a system is going to be doing the thing that we want. And it's not always obvious that even if the system starts out doing like what it looks like what we want, that it won't end up doing something really bad. So a good example is social media feeds, algorithms that keep you coming back to Twitter and all of this stuff. Like, if you think about what is it that Twitter, the company, wants from you, like, you know, it's money, but like, it's pretty benign, right? They just want you to click more and like, yeah. So they're going to, you know, at the first level, what you think of is like, yeah, the algorithm is going to give you posts and tweets that you're going to click on more. So you're going to stay there and see more ads. That's like at the first level. But the problem is that if you train a general system to do this, one of the things that the system will discover is that, hey, I actually, from doing this kind of testing myself on the people that I'm showing these tweets to, I can discover that I can actually make human beings more predictable by showing them certain kinds of content. And one of the ways that that these algorithms are making us more predictable to them is like politicization of content. If I'm more politicized, my clicks are more predictable than they are when my political position is at the center. So one of the things that's actually happening is that these algorithms, purely through the act of trying to make more money, are actually pushing people to different ends of all these different kinds of spectrums, different political issues and all of that, purely because they're like, hey, I'm trying to make you into something that's easier for me to predict. And people who are more extreme politically are just like more predictable because they tend to have a lot of correlated views. So this is one of the ways in which like, it's actually kind of scary, and you can see how it like creeps up on you because this happened over years and years. But you can imagine this, like this is already having an effect on the world. And as these systems become smarter and smarter, we should expect more similar things to be happen, to just begin to happen.
Right, okay. So the primary problem here is we have algorithms that sometimes are too clever in the sense that if we don't think very, very carefully about what we want them, the kind of world we want them to create for us long-term, they'll find solutions that we'd never even imagined could be solutions to the problem. Like if the solution, or if the problem rather, is predict what I'm going to click on so that I can, you know, generate more engaging content, then really like changing my user's mindset to make them more predictable, to turn the political spectrum into more of a binary so that it's a smaller dimensional problem and easier to dimensionality reduce, is that sort of becomes like its own pathology, right? I mean, that's at the core of this, right?
Yeah, and it's the sort of thing that, again, creeps up on you. You can give a system a set of instructions that you think are perfectly benign and totally make sense for you. Make me more money with more clicks. Okay, you know, pretty benign. And it's only with the benefit of hindsight, really, that we can look back and say, like, oh my God, if only we'd known at the time that this was the force we were unleashing upon the world, this, you know, we might have done things differently. But at the time, it was not possible to predict that that this would be the outcome. And this is the problem, is that when you're dealing with something that's smarter than you are, you pretty much by definition, you can't predict what it's going to do because it's smarter than you are. If you were smarter than it, you'd be able to predict it, but because it's smarter than you are, it can predict you and not the other way around.
And I guess it doesn't even necessarily really, I mean, I think this is one of the problems in when you're talking about AI safety, you know, what is smartness? What does intelligence mean? I think these terms are sort of ill-defined. There are certainly senses in which it would be very hard to argue that the Twitter algorithm is smarter than a human. Other senses in which narrowly interpreted, you could say it is smarter than a human, but there's definitely a threshold where the two kind of start to interact and compete, and one algorithm starts to outstrip the other. The Twitter algorithm starts to outstrip your human brain and starts to change you more than you change it, right?
Yeah, I would say that algorithms can be smarter than us currently in narrow ways, but we should be concerned about the possibility that they may become smarter than us in more general ways. And of course, there are other things to be concerned about before even that point is reached.
Okay, so yeah, let's get to, because I think we'll get to the general concern about general intelligence and where these more and more advanced systems might go. In the shorter term, you know, you mentioned Twitter. Obviously, a lot of people have talked about things like AI ethics and AI bias in AI systems, right? And this is, I think, a real theme of the day because we see it around us. We can see systems that operate in ways that have biases that will surprise us. In many cases, they seem to reflect the way that the world currently is, with its current failure modes, and it'll tend to reinforce those failure modes because it's been trained on that data, and it'll make predictions that kind of mirror that data. I guess you're more concerned about the long-termism side of things, but could that be an issue for the long-term as well?
To an extent. So one of the things about the kinds of failure modes and like bias in AI is that in a manner of speaking, this is the sort of thing that is happening to an extent, because these systems are a little bit too dumb. They haven't been trained in general enough ways. The further in the future risks and probably eventually the bigger risks are gonna be what happens when systems are too smart. But the risks of bias are definitely real now, today, and they're current. these biased risks are kind of a turbocharged version of the kinds of what you essentially get when when people build software. They'll generally build for themselves. They'll test the flow of clicks and things that they naturally expect other people to do. They're going to, like, everyone is egocentric, right? So we all basically build for ourselves. And that's perfectly fine, but what can sometimes happen when the data that you collect is biased in a particular way is, like, it's not the algorithm's fault. The algorithm is just running on the data it's been given, and it can just, like, totally forget that, oh, you know, there's a bunch of people that, like, don't have names written in Latin characters, or that don't have a particular skin color or whatever. And so you actually can get, of course, these situations where an algorithm is very bad at dealing with cases that the developers didn't think of. And the more power, again, we give to these systems, the more costly those mistakes become. So I would say that's currently the status of bias in AI.
Right. And I guess there's one, I mean, people talk a lot about data set bias. That gets a lot of attention. I think one other really important aspect is feature selection bias. Because if you think about it, like, human beings collect features about the rest of the world as we navigate our environment. Those features typically are things like sound waves. They're things like smells. There's things like vision and touch. Those are the features that evolution has engineered for us. Because we see the world through that lens, we are unable to notice certain things. These are things, for example, like the neutrinos that fly right through our bodies all the time that we're totally insensitive to, and yet that account for a large or not inconsiderate fraction of the amount of energy that we're bathed in at any given moment in time. So I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that our environment goes mostly unseen. And even the things that we could in principle see, we're so myopically focused on one, like, tiny fraction of our visual field that we don't take in, the overwhelming majority of the information around us. When it comes to our machines, I think, we're doing something similar. We select features. When you tell, for example, if you were to tell a credit card pricing algorithm, like the name, age, occupation, and skin color of a person, you've just caused it to look at the world through a certain lens. And that biases it to find certain correlations more easily than others, or mm-hmm. to fold complexities and nuances into one high-level coarse-grained feature. Is that something that that you see as well as an issue, or do you think that the data set bias is a bigger problem?
So what I would say there is that there are two kinds of biases that can arise from feature selection. The first is an omission bias, where you don't give the system an informative feature. Like, you give the system a feature that is not informative with respect to the conclusion. The second is more like labeling bias. And so in the event where you give a system, the skin color of someone for credit card assessment, if you were actually training the system on, like, a truly, ground truth informative data set, in theory, that skin color thing shouldn't end up mattering. Like, if you have a perfectly general intelligence that's running on that system, it's going to ignore skin color to the extent that skin color needs to be ignored. But the problem is that when you have, when you're training that system on labels that have been put there by people who themselves have biases, which, we all have, then that bias itself gets induced onto the system. And this is the sort of thing that, like, one encounters in terms of potentially, like, an algorithm delivering a verdict, for example. If it turns out that the verdicts that it's seen before are delivered by, there's a significant sample of those verdicts that are biased against, who knows, the height or the skin color or the hair color or whatever of the person, then, this, again, the system, it's garbage in, garbage out. The system is going to learn what you teach it. And so it's going to have the same exact biases induced on it.
So I guess that's interesting. I guess I see the case of biased data as one part of this. I don't think it's the case that, you talked about a sufficiently generally intelligent program that would look at this information, including skin color and so on, and then go about drawing the right kinds of conclusions. I don't think that's actually the case. I think if you, unless that system has access to a fuller set of features, it will tend to see things myopically through the particular lens that it's given on the world. And sometimes that lens, even if the data set isn't biased, even if it detects just what's happening in the world, if we talk about skin color or we talk about gender or whatever, there are correlations between skin color and tendency to pay down debts or whatever. And those are reflected in, the biases, if you will, of a poorly engineered system. But what's really going on under the surface is if you kind of part that out, if you control for other variables, all of a sudden we expect, I don't know that anyone's actually done this, but I would highly expect personally that skin color would iron out of that equation, but only if you control for these other variables. So I think it's only to the extent that you add to that feature set that you can actually de-bias the system in that way.
Yes, this is correct. This is I think another way of looking at what I was saying in terms of there's sins of omission that you can make. So to the extent that you have given the system enough ground truth data to actually break down those variables that ultimately make these like gender and other these confounding features, I guess, irrelevant. To the extent you've given the system that extent of data, it will learn that those variables are irrelevant. But yes, if you make those omissions, it may actually learn on variables and exhibit a bias as a result.
Yeah, I think it's always interesting as well the extent to which all this challenges to our notion of free will or maybe illusion of free will. Because I can imagine as well, if you take this process to its limit and you keep fine graining and adding more features and adding more features, eventually your model becomes so sophisticated, it can account for, I mean, almost like in the absurd limit, the firing patterns of every neuron in your brain. And then you can predict your behavior with super high levels of certainty and all your agency kind of disappears. I see that actually kind of as an interesting part of the journey we're going to have to make as systems become more sophisticated.
I think that's true to an extent, but there's a limit to that. So it's the same as predicting the weather. Systems that have, even if you're not thinking about, oh, there's quantum mechanical uncertainty on top of everything, even if you're not thinking about that, classical systems that have chaotic properties have, you can't really predict them beyond a certain number of time steps. The way it works is that, I think, if I recall correctly, it's something like your however much accuracy you have in the beginning, the accuracy that you have later goes down as 1/ the square root of the time. So basically, after a certain period of time, even if you have a perfectly deterministic model of how stuff's going to happen, if your accuracy of measurement at the beginning basically propagates and gets much, much worse over time. So there will always be a limit to the extent to which very intelligent systems are able to predict the future. At least that's our best current understanding now. But you don't need to be able to predict the movement of every single atom to be able to do a lot of very instrumentally effective things that could be dangerous.
Yeah, and I think there's actually maybe the sidebar to this is there's already been a story in the UK about the government trying to, not the government, sorry, I think a university trying to predict students' test scores, given that they weren't able, for whatever reason, I think it might've been COVID related, they weren't able to actually write the test, right? And so you've got students who you might say arguably are rightly upset that their agency has been stripped away. In this case, it seemed as though the algorithm was non-performative. It overstated, as often machine learning models do nowadays, but it overstated its accuracy downplayed its uncertainty. However, I think there's an interesting question as to, okay, well, what if that hadn't been the case? What if the algorithm had been super performative? Where would we be there? And yeah.
Well, if you think of it in a certain way, the test itself is an uncertain evaluation of your own, it's a noisy evaluation of your own skill. And so if you have a good day on the test, you should be happier. You've gotten an extra bonus. Whereas if you just had a bad day, had a bad night's sleep, whatever it is, some sort of mix of stuff, you maybe should be rightly indignant that this test didn't correctly assess your level. So I think that ultimately it might be more of a semantic and comfort zone issue than a real issue If you have a perfectly unbiased algorithm with a known uncertainty. So if your algorithm is unbiased and well-calibrated, because if it's unbiased and well-calibrated, then I can at least look at my test score or my predicted test score and say, well, there's a 50-50 chance I should be mad about this and a 50-50 chance I should be happy about it. On the other hand, we all have a natural discomfort in having a computer judge our futures. So I don't know that we as a civilization will ever get over that necessarily.
Right, which I guess starts to invite some of the parts of this conversation that I think are more forward-looking. So as we keep developing this technology, you alluded to this earlier, you know, the more powerful these systems get, the more important it's going to become for us to know exactly what we want. And this idea of being able to build systems that know exactly what we want, being able to communicate that to them, being able to make sure that they're actually doing exactly what we've asked them to do, is known as AI alignment. What I'd like to do is ask you, can you describe AI alignment sort of in your own words? And then maybe can you provide a description overall of like maybe the outer alignment versus inner alignment problems as well, just so people are a little bit more familiar with them?
Yeah, so roughly speaking, the problem of AI alignment is the problem of getting an AI to do what we truly want it to do. There's a lot of detail in that description, and even a big part of the alignment problem that's still open is figuring out exactly how much detail there is left to figure out in that description. Right now, people tend to break down alignment into two sub-questions, like you said. There's outer alignment and inner alignment. So the first problem is getting the system, getting this big AI to actually try to do what we want it to do. And so this you can think about as the problem of, I found a magic lamp, I rub the lamp and a genie comes out. It's not the genie from Aladdin. It's not like this, you know, really like nice genie who's like trying to be helpful and stuff. It's a genie that like will try really hard to misinterpret your wish as hard as possible. And the genie's also much smarter than you. So what you have to do is you have to figure out a way to word your wish so that you absolutely pin down that genie, so they absolutely cannot misinterpret your wish in any meaningful way. And they're like, ugh, I guess I'm going to do this thing because like you've left me no other choice.
So this is interesting because you immediately frame this as an adversarial thing, which I think is interesting in and of itself. But the implication is that this AI or this genie is trying to misinterpret what we're saying, which I don't, you know, is not the case, but it does seem, at least as somebody who's been in the space and worked with you on a lot of the stuff, it definitely does seem as though in practice you have to, it's almost like defensive driving. You have to assume because this thing is so powerful, so much more intelligent than you are, if you're building super powerful, super intelligent AI systems, that it's going to find a solution to whatever problem you present it with that is going to be way too clever and that will involve doing things that you can't even imagine, right? Like, is that where this adversarial implication comes from?
To an extent, yes. I think the simplest way to put it is that there are way more ways to misinterpret a wish than there are to correctly interpret a wish. And the smarter you are, the more ways to misinterpret the wish you're going to be able to think of. So the genie that you're facing is able to think of a lot of ways to misinterpret your wish, whereas you're like, no, 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 I want you to interpret it correctly in one of these areas.
So can you give an example of a wish actually that might help flesh this out?
Yeah, yeah. Let's say I wish to... something simple like I wish to be happy or something like that. Okay, like you wish to be happy. If you're facing a person who really wants to be helpful and who has all the constraints of a person, you know, they'll ask you like, what do you want? Like, I'll make you a cup of coffee, whatever, you know, makes you happy in the moment. But if you're facing a super intelligent genie, what the genie is gonna say is like, first it's gonna be like, okay, well, you know, how do you define happiness? There's a lot of fuzziness there. Is it that I'm like smiling all the time? Well, if that's how the genie thinks what happiness is, it's going to like, you know, grab onto my face and like force me to smile forever. And great, it's done its job. But I'm like, no, 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 like don't do that. Please stop. But that the point is, it's not listening. It doesn't want to listen. I've already told it, make me happy. It thinks that making me happy means making me smile, and more
or any number of other things, right?
Like, it could
be juicing you up on drugs. It could be any, yeah.
Yeah. Like, oh, like then I'll just inject you with cocaine, or like, oh, like I'll drill into your skull, pull out your brain and like drop you in a vat of endorphins and like that'll do it or whatever it is. But the problem is, once you've given the genie that very first directive, from that point, it also has the incentive to prevent a change in that directive, because it's going to, like, it doesn't want, once it has that directive, it's got this goal, and it's going to try to do everything it can to accomplish that goal. One of the things that will reduce the chance of that goal being accomplished is if the genie's own goal is changed by you afterwards. So if you are able to tell the genie, oh, actually, no, like, don't do that, like, smiley face thing, that's like really scary, please don't do that, that reduces the chance of you ending up being happy and forcibly smiled. And so the genie, before you tell it stop smiling, but after you told it like make me smile, is gonna be like, okay, now that I've gotten this directive, I have to like prevent my directive from being changed, defend myself against any attempt to change it, including by the guy who just asked me to do this thing. So like, right. I better just like, you know, force this guy to stop talking, or like just quickly kill him and make his face smiley anyway. And like, that's happy, or some crazy stuff like that. This is the level of misinterpretation that we're talking about. It's why it's dangerous.
Yeah. A lot of this reminds me of, you know, the early days of, or the early days, my first interaction with computers, right? And I think everybody experiences this. When you first start to code, you realize that, man, this machine is taking me absolutely literally. Like, I tell it to do something, and I mean, I remember having this frustration. You write some code that you think should work. You think it should work, and then you hit run, and then it breaks, and there's an error message. And then you, what do? You get frustrated, not with yourself, but with the machine, because your brain is telling you, oh, the machine screwed up. I know what I meant, but the machine misinterpreted it. And I think that there's a similar kind of error that gets made when people look at AI and start to think of it as if it's going to be default positive as an outcome. There's a lot of anthropomorphizing that people do, where they imagine like, oh, it'll, you know, but it'll get that I don't mean like this horrible way of achieving the thing that I just asked it to do, or, you know, I won't have a genie take me literally is the assumption. And anyway, it strikes me that really does reflect like my own attitude when I was starting to learn how to program. It's like a totally understandable way of approaching these problems.
Yeah, the machine has no sympathy intrinsically, except to the extent that we give it sympathy, and we don't understand sympathy well enough to give a machine sympathy. So that's like, and that's one part of the problem, but it's like, it's a part of the problem.
Right. Okay. So we've established that it's not going to be trivial to train this this advanced AI in order to get it to do what we want. I mean, that's the other thing, right? Like, when you tell a machine, I would like to be happy. There's so many things that get rolled into that. I mean, philosophers have been trying to figure out what it means to be happy for thousands of years with no success. And now we're going to try to quantify that complete uncertainty and feed it to machines. So I guess that's hinting at another part of the problem here. But suppose we got past that, and this is what you were saying referred to as the outer alignment problem. What's the next layer of difficulty, as hard as that was? What's the next piece here?
Yeah, so the next piece is what's called the inner alignment problem. And this is more like the genie you're talking to might be made up of a lot of internal components, and those internal components might be working against the interests of the genie. So this is kind of hard to picture, but maybe a good way of thinking about this kind of anthropomorphically is, You think of a company. Let's say that instead of a genie, you know, you were making a request to a company, you know, make me happy, and the company charges you money or whatever to make you happy and something like that. So the company might well, you know, have a pathological tendency to make you happy or whatever, like Twitter does. I mean, I love Twitter, but it does have this this algorithm problem. But what's interesting about a company is that a company is made up of people that all are partly aligned with the goals of the company. The people work together to accomplish something that more than what any individual person in the company could have done. But they're not all rowing exactly the same direction. There are people inside the company that are more aligned than others. Some people really deeply believe in the company's mission and they'll put in like all the hours they need. They're ambitious in the same direction, all that. Other people are have a variety of different motivations. They just want to, you know, get home at 5 p.m. and see their kids. That's one motivation. That's perfectly fine. There's other motivations, like some people are going to, be working just for their own ambition, their own personal ambition to rise to the ladder. They have no interest in the company's own success or outcome. And other people are just like, they're literally freeloaders. Like they're literally doing crimes and embezzling the company and like, you know, selling Twitter accounts to hackers or some crazy stuff like that. It's going to be a tiny, tiny fractional number of people like this. And the entire company itself, the goal of that company is to keep them all aligned and doing the same thing. But when we take that framework and transport it over onto something that's an AI, it's not actually clear to what extent it's not clear what it takes to get the AI to get its internal components all aligned together. You can think of it as it's the same problem basically as the outer alignment problem. It's as if the genie itself contains a bunch of little genies in it that are trying to solve the sub problems, but those little genies might be acting against the main genie, and the main genie needs to think carefully about the instructions it gives to its little genies.
So what are some examples of sub-problems that might lead to the formation of these, by the way, these little genies, right? I mean, in the language of AI alignment, these are MISA optimizers. That's usually what they're referred to as. So a MISA optimizer it's kind of like an optimizer within an optimizer. So you have this machine learning algorithm, and then within it, there are a whole bunch of sub-problems that have to be solved in order for the overall algorithm to work. So if you're doing computer vision, right, part of the overall vision problem of computer vision is, for example, recognizing edges and corners, right? Mm-hmm. So you might have a little MISA optimizer in one that specializes in edges and another one that specializes in corners. And these kind of can take on a life of their own to some degree. I guess that's the concern, at least. And to the extent that they do that, they want to protect themselves in the same way, I guess this is what you're saying with outer alignment, right? In the same way as the outer aligned agent doesn't want to be reprogrammed, it wants to retain its original purpose. These MISA optimizers don't want to, once they've latched onto their subproblem, they don't want that subproblem to be changed. And so desperately want to preserve their own structure, right?
Yeah. So one example of this, if you go back to like the genie putting your brain in like a vat of endorphins and whatnot, the genie, like you give it the instruction, like maybe happy. And the genie's like, oh, I'll put his brain into a vat of endorphins. That's what I'll do. Then what it does is it assigns to one of its subcomponents the subproblem of, okay, like in order to make this work, we're gonna have to figure out like a lot of stuff about human neurochemistry. So like get working on that. And we've got a bunch of other subproblems too. And then maybe the thing that's working on human neurochemistry has some version of the thought process of, oh wow, man, this is a hard problem. I need lots of computers, like more computing power than I currently have in order to solve this subproblem. Okay, I'm gonna like convert a lot of the atoms in the world and the solar system and the galaxy into more computers to make sure that I've really, really well solved this subproblem of figuring out human neurochemistry so that then I can pass that solution upwards to like the main optimizer that's solving the big problem. Maybe the big optimizer is using computers over here, but I want those computers to solve my subproblem. And so you get this kind of fight happen. It's actually, you can kind of feel a similar thing happening within your own mind. So if you're deciding, you know, hey, I want to, do I want to eat like that cookie over there? It doesn't feel like, you know, you have a one coherent loss function for your entire life and you're trying to compute expected values over it. Instead, it feels like there's a whole like separate thing in your head that's dedicated to solving a subproblem. So you have like the hunger module in your head that's fighting you for control. And the hunger module is like, yes, yes, go for the cookie. But you know, you've got a higher level process that goes like, oh, well, hang on, how does that fit into my life goals of not getting fat or whatever your life goals are? But that it feels like you're fighting a part of yourself in that decision.
Right. And so, there's so many places we could go with this having introduced these optimizers, but I think one thing that's worth pausing on and noting here is, first off, this stuff can sound understandably a little bit out there and wild, right? I mean, we're talking really about machines that to some degree want to take over the world. I think it's worth pointing out that, or at least, you know, in some modes of operation, they will tend to, if they are sufficiently powerful, have sufficient compute, have access to enough data, eventually develop ambitions like that. This, it does sound wild, but it is a very, very well-established, it's what's known as an instrumental objective of machine learning models in this kind of stage. It's something that at the very least, very serious researchers focus on as a problem. I mean, this is considered a very serious issue in the alignment community. Can we talk a little bit about this idea of instrumental objectives? What is an instrumental objective? Can you define that?
Yeah. So what you said earlier about basically we think that all systems that are smart enough, or the vast majority of systems that are smart enough, will want to, after some fashion, take over the world, which sounds like a very extreme claim. And the reason is exactly this idea of instrumental goals and instrumental convergence. The idea is that there are certain resources and there are certain actions that are good bets to take and to seize no matter what your goal is. So if your goal is to put my brain in a vat, you kind of saw how, the sub-optimizer wants more computers to make sure it absolutely nails the problem and gets it right. That's kind of a part of it. In order to solve a hard problem, you need lots of computers. And when there are no real limits placed on your power, what you can do, there's no reason why you wouldn't just convert the entire Earth and every particle of mass that you can get your hands on into a computer. Like, again, there's nothing approaching sympathy that is even in the concept space of something like this. So
you could certainly argue that's what humans are trying to do already. I mean, we are quite literally converting as much of the world as we possibly can into compute resources, which we're then deploying to solve our own instrumental goals.
And even that is with, you know, we have limits to our capabilities, and even we have sympathy for the animals that we're killing, the trees we're destroying, the environment. Like, you know, we not all of us do, but like enough of us do that we're like, hey guys, like we need natural preserve, national parks, all these sorts of things. That's because we, to an extent, value these things enough that we're, you know, not willing to maybe utterly annihilate the planet to get them. But if our goal function were different, we wouldn't even care that much. And then, yeah, who cares about the rainforest? Who cares about this and that? And that's ultimately what we would be dealing with. And, you know, imagine the plight of an African lion or something faced with that degree of destructiveness, which is far worse than even the degree of destructiveness that we've imposed on lions already. It's just like, it's incomprehensible, just zero sympathy, totally mechanical and utterly destructive.
And this is, I mean, one famous example or how you get to this is this idea of the paperclip optimizer, basically, you know, the device that's told, hey, make paperclips. And just without any other context, it goes, oh, cool, there's some iron like in the ground, there's some iron in your blood, there's some iron here, some iron there. It just collects iron from everywhere and you destroy the world making paperclips. Mm-hmm. Cool. So I guess one last note, I guess, on the instrumental convergence idea, there are instrumental goals or a number of different instrumental goals that many people consider to be plausible, things that machines will tend to optimize towards as a side effect of trying to optimize a main objective function. Can you list a couple of these? I know you've alluded to a number of them, but maybe just so people can see some.
Yeah, at a fundamental level, based on, you know, based on the laws of physics that we know of today, you know, matter and free energy, you want stuff and you want the juice to run it. So in other words, as much put matter together to build lots of computers so you can think as fast and as effectively as possible, and grab the energy sources that you need to actually run those computers. And there are other instrumental goals like survival. Generally speaking, I can predict that if I survive, my goals are more likely to be accomplished than if I die. In most cases, if I have a certain set of goals, like if I'm around to continue pursuing them, those goals are more likely to get accomplished. So self-preservation is one of these instrumental sub-goals. And a goal, like goal cohesiveness or goal preservation, is also an instrumental sub-goal. So if I remain alive, but the goal that I'm given in my brain is changed, then the previous goal that I had is also less likely to be accomplished because I would be no longer working on it after my goal was changed. And so I'm going to seek to prevent my goal from being changed. So I get, you know, in at least like, as we kind of expect, we get basically one shot to set the goal right. Because otherwise, like if we're like, oh, no, wait, then, you know, presumably the system can be like, oh, no, hang on. I got this. Like I got this goal and I'm going to accomplish it.
Well, so that, and I think that reflects to some degree, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, maybe your tendency towards one of the camps in the AI alignment debate. So there's the camp that says, guys, we get one shot at this. We got to make sure that we get our goals right. And there's another camp that says, guys, we should be focused on robustness, making models that account for their uncertainty with respect to the goals that they pursue, and trying to be corrigible, in other words, invite corrections and be robust in that sense. Just wanted to kind of flag the distinction between the two because it is sort of two branches of the ecosystem. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, the argument starts to get a bit technical in those areas. I would say that both are viable directions, and certainly, you know, there are probably going to be phases, you know, before we make some kind of super evil genie that can destroy the world, where we definitely want to be more in learning mode than in, I got this exactly right mode. So that we can actually look at like, okay, like what is systems that are like pretty smart and like maybe dangerous, but not necessarily instantaneously destructive. What do they do after they've been given a set of instructions? Is there a way we can make them okay with having a switch flipped so they're stopped? All that sort of thing.
Cool. Okay, so having laid that foundation, I think a lot of this will be, it'll probably be old news to people who are familiar with the AI alignment ecosystem, but maybe new stuff for folks who are joining us from the last series where we're doing more of a data science career-focused stuff. One thing I want to do is, because you and I have talked a lot about MISA optimizers, I think one of the really interesting things that the concept of MISA optimizers does is it does give us, I think, a pretty interesting perspective on what humanity is, what life is, what the universe is, really. And I wanted to explore that if you're okay with it, just kind of airing some of our private conversations out here a little bit. This is part of the reason why I wanted to invite you on the podcast. So are you cool with that?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, great. So I guess maybe I'm trying to think of a question to start us off with, but maybe I'll just provide a framing and you can take it from there. So we've discussed the idea that that essentially every organism in the universe can be seen as a MISA optimizer. So essentially what's happening is the universe has a whole bunch of atoms. It has a whole bunch of photons, particles, all kinds of different degrees of freedom. And it's running this experiment. It's training on whatever reshuffling of particles will randomly tend to occur. So it's kind of, you've got this interaction between particles that's going on over time. And over time, it seems that the jumbling of particles is tending towards self-assembly of complex systems. And Whatever the final end state of the universe is like, it seems like we're tending towards one of greater and greater and greater complexity. To the extent that humans don't wipe themselves out, to the extent that we actually survive to the point where we create a self-improving AI system, it really seems like we're iterating on our way to something like an intelligence explosion, as it's kind of been referred to. In that framing, we're here to compete with all these other MISA optimizers around us. So we want access, like you were saying, you've got that MISA optimizer that's specialized in understanding human neurochemistry so that it can, so that the overall problem of putting your brain in a vat of endorphins can be solved. Well, humans are focused on solving the problem of being really, really good humans and surviving and kind of propagating. Maybe I'll park the thought there.
I think that's a good place to start. So we and all the other animals and organisms in the world, we're all on the inside of a giant optimizer that's evolving us, right? So evolution is kind of the big process that's trying to drive us towards genetic fitness. So we're our evolutionary directive is have lots of kids relative to the size of the population. Like, increase your genetic representation in the next generation. That's our evolutionary directive. What's interesting is that, especially recently, humans really don't seem to be following that directive very well. If we were actually following that directive, if we were actually I want as many kids as possible compared to, we would be acting quite differently. We would not be using birth control, for example. We would probably not be using condoms. There's a bunch of other things that we would be having more kids as opposed to, fertility drops and stuff like that. So this is a signal that something has gone wrong. There's something mismatched between evolution's slow optimization pressure and the stuff that we're doing and learning to do. We are actuated by desires like hunger, sex drive, fear, anger, all these sorts of things that correlated very well to our inclusive genetic fitness for a very long time. These are really complex adaptations. They evolved over millions and millions of years. Many animals that are unrelated to us probably feel them, animals probably feel fear and all of that sort of thing. So something is happening. There's an increasing amount of space between evolution giving us telling us what to do in a certain sense and our own internal drives telling us what to do. And our internal drives, we're able to satisfy those internal drives in ways that evolution would look at if it was a person and be like, hey, whoa, that's pathological. You guys are doing something wrong here. You're optimizing too much for your hunger. You're getting fat and not having kids. What's this? You're optimizing too much for your sex drive and having sex with condoms. You're not having kids.
It almost feels like from evolution standpoint, evolution is like the human trying to get the code and the AI right so that it doesn't go off track. Yeah. And what's happening now is evolution programs you to have a whole bunch of kids. And then instead of getting horny and having sex with people and having kids, you start to watch pornography and evolution goes, whoa, 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 that's not what I meant. Yeah, you can't cheat like that.
And that's the key. Evolution isn't actually programming us to have kids. Evolution found an easier way to do it. Evolution was if I just put these little actuators on my thing, the organism is going to figure out how to have kids from there. The problem is when the organism gets really, really smart, it figures out how to satisfy those desires without doing the thing that evolution wanted it to do.
It transcends that initial loss function, basically. And I think, so you alluded to more and more daylight between what evolution wants humans to do and what humans end up actually doing. I think it's worth exploring what the source of that daylight is, because, correct me if I'm wrong, based on our conversations, I think we're aligned on this, but I think it comes down to computational capacity, right? Eventually, the organism is capable of running more computation than evolution itself. you're able to essentially, you have enough compute power that natural selection isn't the main thing that's changing you. Now, the main thing that's changing you is your own thinking, your own cognitive capacity. And so over the course of a human lifetime, you can actually change yourself much more than evolution would allow if you were like a water buffalo or something.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that this has to do with how dense versus how sparse the internal versus the external feedback signals are, and how many processing steps.
So can you elaborate on that? What do you mean by dense and sparse here?
Yeah. So like evolution sends you a really sparse fitness signal. It sends a fitness signal that's like, it happens like every 20 or 30 years. Like, you know, do you have kids? Do they have kids? Like every 20 or 30 years. And like, did you die in that time before having kids?
Right.
That's like, that's a very sparse signal. It doesn't like punch you in the face very often, but it punches hard when it does. Whereas your own internal processes send you, like in that 30 year time span, you might get, God, I don't even know. Maybe, I don't know. You get like hungry, God knows what, like three times a day and whatever that is in 30 years, like thousands and tens of thousands.
You bump your elbow and you scratch your knee and
That's it. And so what happens is like you have degrees of freedom in between those like bump, like pulses of evolutionary pressure signal to adapt yourself around your own like brain signals. So the way it works is that evolution is providing feedback pressure on the way your own signals are arranged. So evolution manages the balance between like, how hungry do you get? How horny do you get? How mad do you get? How happy do you get? All those things. Evolution manages that on a time scale of decades. But within your brain, you have a set arrangement of those signals and you're internally optimizing and processing on a time scale that's many tens of thousands to like millions of times faster than that. And as a result, you have the space to be super focused on those signals in a way that evolution doesn't really account for. Our processing power is greater, is now too great to be ruled by these signals. And even like it's to the point where, you know, it's plausible that soon we'll be able to alter our own DNA directly and just completely decouple ourselves. And so we'll be following, we're still slaves to evolution, but we're just like, from evolution's point of view, we're these misshapen, pathological slaves that are no longer slaves to it directly, but that are slaves to like the clumsy, clunky things that it built.
Well, it's interesting that you're saying from evolution's perspective, right? But evolution, of course, is whatever evolution gives rise to. I mean, by definition, we are the goal. So to me, this is exactly that difference between, this is the outer alignment issue. Something is being optimized for in this universe. It's clearly not biological evolution. That was what was being optimized for a period of time of about 14 billion years leading up to the present day. But in the last few hundred thousand years, human beings have started to decouple, to lift off, as our cognitive capacity has created daylight between what evolution wants us to do and the timeline, as you said, on which evolution gives us feedback and the timeline on which we're able to get feedback from our environments. And that's not by any means the end of the process, right? This is what brings us back to the AI discussion. There's an extra step here where we shift substrates, where we're no longer running computation on biological hardware, but we're running computation on a substrate of silicon rather than cells. And to the extent that happens, you start to relax a lot of the constraints that make humans so incredibly slow compared to machines. And we might have the same paradigm play out at an even tighter timescale.
Yeah, this is right. So one of the issues with computers is that, they're so much faster than us. Like they're as much faster than us in terms of like the serial depth of a computation. Like in other words, I do this, then I do that, then I do that. The number of things that they can do one after the other, they're as much faster than us as we are faster than the evolutionary process in terms of its ability to, you know, switch out genes and test out new life forms and so forth. And so as a result, you know, you can kind of make the analogy of like, oh, you know, I build this thing and it's so much faster than me. I give it these kind of clunky, coarsely defined goals that correlate pretty well to my goals at first, but then it optimizes and optimizes and optimizes, gets smarter and smarter, and like very, very quickly, perhaps is able to satisfy the coarse goals that I gave it in a way that, you know, I had no idea. I was like, oh my God, this is not what I meant. Stop, stop, stop. But by then, you know, we don't care. Evolution might be thinking the same thing about us, but like, we don't care about it. We do what we want.
Yeah. And just as evolution seems to stand still relative to the pace of a human life will appear to stand still relative to the pace of the evolution of this artificial intelligence. I mean, yes, whatever form it takes. Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's a big pro in favor of your earlier argument that we have one shot to get this right. I guess one of the concerns too, as we start to look into this domain of or time domain where AI is starting to pick up, more and more progress is being made, more and more general systems are being built, things like GPT-3, but not only that, we're gonna get more and more advanced systems very soon. We start to get into this domain where we're at the mercy of like the least AI safety aware company that wants to design a program, right? I mean, this is the domain of AI policy where you start to say, okay, how do you get the game theory to work here? How do you prevent some foolish company that decides to say, oh, I'm not particularly concerned about AI alignment. It doesn't, you know, I'm not worried about this. How do you prevent them from then, you know, taking some very irresponsible action in this direction? Do you have any, I know this is maybe less so your area, but do you have any thoughts on the AI policy side with respect to that game theory?
Well, yeah. So on the economics of it, like, there's a lot of talk about democratizing AI, and that's good. That's good up to a point, I think. When you're starting to talk about these very, very big and extremely capable systems that start to potentially present dangers, not just like they could take over the world, but dangers like long before that, like they could be abused by someone to send, you know, massive amounts of crafted spam or just all sorts of novel kinds of risks. So the economics of it are that like the closer to a monopoly you are, the more margin your business has. And here I'm talking about it as though it's a business, because like these models are being built to be sold as APIs and all of this.
And we say the more margin, really you mean the more profit. And like,
so that's actually that's part of what I mean. When I say margin, like that margin can go to profit. It can absolutely go to profit. And up till this point, it's gone to profit, but it can also go to safety. It can go to safety investment. Mm-hmm. So when you're, you know, a monopoly, you can, let's say you charge like a 50% profit margin, 50% of the dollars that come in are yours to keep, and you can do whatever you want with them. Yes, you can use them, you know, for on your balance sheet and like, oh, now I have more money. That's great. But another thing you do with them is commit them to keeping your systems secure and safe. And that takes an increasing amount of investment. One of the issues of having like a widely competitive landscape with lots and lots of these different models being sold is that they are, when they compete against each other, each company and each, you know, each company with each model, they compete their margins away. And in capitalism, you know, that's generally seen as good. That's good because it means that consumers are paying less. If a company is mean or evil or whatever, I can switch to another company and it's, you know, cheaper for everybody. In the case of a system that has the potential to be dangerous, it's what you kind of want, ideally, is like one monopoly that's spending all of its margin budget on safety and not having too many with limited amounts of margin. They're competing with each other, so they can't spend it on safety. This is potentially a risky arrangement to have.
Yeah, there's definitely, I've seen arguments for what this is called multipolarity or unipolarity, mm-hmm. essentially the idea of like how many different poles, how many different companies or organisms, organizations have, you know, active AI efforts or cutting edge AI efforts? And how does that affect the risk landscape? I've seen arguments that say, you know, multipolarity might be more desirable. I personally lean definitely in the direction that you've just discussed there. I know we've talked about it a fair bit. I think another pretty convinced, oh, sorry, did you want to add something there?
I was just going to say, you might be able to make multipolarity work if you had, you know, an organization that was purely dedicated to safety, very well funded, and also had a lot of internal transparency into what all the other companies were building.
Right.
That might be a way to make it work, but that seems hard, at least in the current arrangement of things.
Yeah, I know OpenAI put together a piece of policy work researching basically like moving towards a more transparent way of developing AI internally within organizations. A big part of the game theory behind this is trust. You know, if you're Google and you're working towards a super powerful AGI that could potentially be dangerous, and you know Facebook tells you they're working towards that as well, but you and you both claim to each other that you're investing a lot of effort into safety to make sure nothing horrible happens. Like, how much should you trust that that's actually happening at the other company and that they're not actually just taking all their margin and throwing it out competing you to develop a product faster? And that's
like one of the good scenarios. These are two companies that are, culturally aligned, exchange employees a lot, are based, you know, roughly on the same strip of the Bay Area. They're extremely similar companies in a lot of ways. And you know, how does the trust picture change when you're dealing with companies that are from different countries, don't speak the same language, have never exchanged employees, have different governmental structures and fundamentally different value systems? Like, it becomes quite different and more difficult for trust to be established in that case.
Yeah. And I think maybe the most appropriate analogy is, it depends how you take it. So people, especially those who argue for multipolarity, one common argument focuses on the more mesoscopic domain between super powerful systems and current day systems, where they say, look, there's the risk of AI being deployed to weapon systems. Now, it may be good that you have multipolarity, because who knows how the Cold War would have unfolded if just one country had access to nukes and no other country could engage in mutually assured destruction with them, thereby making sure that nobody would ever fire their nukes. Maybe something like that would happen with AI. I think there are compelling reasons why that's not the case, or at least I've taken that view in the past, but yeah, sorry.
I think this is basically the capitalistic argument for competition, that under all of the circumstances that we've seen pretty much up to this point, competition has been a good thing. It's been good that a lot of different organizations have similar technologies that can compete with each other and keep each other in check and so forth. And this may continue to be true with AI up to a certain level of capability, but I would suspect that there's going to come a level of capability beyond which safety investment becomes more important than capability investment. And that's the point at which you basically need a lot of margin to commit to safety. And so some arrangement that's equivalent or isomorphic to a monopoly.
Yeah. And I mean, certainly we see that with like, you know, tabletop bioweapons or bioengineering, where designer pathogens are going to be a plausible reality fairly soon. And likewise with nuclear weapons, right? I mean, you get to a point where, okay, it's time to stop publishing results out in the open. I think OpenAI itself, to their credit, as at least from my perspective, has, and they've taken a lot of flack for it. They've come out and said, look, as we start to approach greater and greater capabilities, we're going to have to start bringing some of our work in-house and not publishing as widely. They've been more and more cautious. We heard with GPT-2, their first step in that direction. Now GPT-3 is kind of entirely in-house. None of it is public domain. Like, it's not just an open source model. Anyway, it's going to be interesting to see how the field evolves and develops. Obviously, there's a lot of controversy with any decision made in the space. I think given the stakes, though, one of the key things is really like targeting policies that are robustly good. As you and I have seen, as we've engaged with, you know, everyone from policymakers to AI alignment researchers, it's so easy to make moves that end up doing more harm than good if you're not really, really careful in the space. So I guess what I wanted to do was close off this conversation with just an appeal to people who are listening. You know, if you're interested in AI alignments, AI safety, anything like that, if you find the risks that we've been talking about here compelling and interesting to work on, then check out some of the links that we'll provide with the blog post and in the description of the video, because there are a number of organizations you might want to check out just to kind of see what your options are, where you might be able to contribute. But looking at things through the lens of what's robustly good, you know, what's likely to really not do more harm than good under unexpected shifts, because things can go wrong in surprising ways when you're talking about cutting edge technology. Anyway, just something I wanted to throw out there because we've run into some of these issues ourselves.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. It's important first to, it's one of those, it's sort of a first do no harm type of thing. It's a Hippocratic oath, I guess, on a bigger scale. But yeah, I think that's where the first effort should be directed, is like, how can we do stuff that avoids bad consequences going forward and keeps everyone in a nice state.
Awesome. Okay. Well, Ed, I really appreciate it. I think what we'll do is I'll link obviously your own personal website in the description of all this stuff too. Anything you wanted to share? I guess, do you mind sharing your Twitter so people can follow you?
Sure. Yep. I'm at Neutrons Neurons, or Neurons Neutrons. I actually forget. Sorry, man.
We'll link to it. Yeah.
Neutrons Neurons. I'm at Neutrons Neurons. So you can hit me up and drop a follow there.
Fantastic. All right. Well, thanks so much, Ed. I really appreciate it. Great conversation.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. We'll keep it going offline. Cheers.
Cheers.